Hi, Chief Halton here at Fire Engineering Podcasts, and we are being brought to you by Tenkata Protective Fabrics and their Made for Life podcast hosted by Stuart Perry. The Made for Life podcast unearths the work experiences of real men and women who rely on the protective clothing and equipment to get the job done. From firefighters to industrial workers to military personnel, recent episodes explore the dangers and challenges of wildland firefighting, peer counseling for first responders, and the ins and outs of turnout gear. It's the Made for Life podcast from Tenkata Fabrics. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And thank you for listening to Fire Engineering.
Well, welcome to Firefighter Behavioral Health with Dr. Beth Murphy. Again tonight, I'm the I don't know if I'm the driver or the tillerman in this adventure, but today we're going to do sort of a mix of law and psychology, kind of given the background, excuse me, whereas yesterday Beth and I went over to a department in Eastern Washington to talk about mandatory COVID vaccines, the stress that it's putting on not only the individuals, but the organizations themselves. And some of the litigation that's going on in Washington State especially, but we're seeing more and more of it around the country with police unions and fire unions, EMS organizations pushing back against the mandates that President Biden put into place that affects 100 employees or more. I just read today that Medicare and Medicaid, if you're collecting those particular fees, will require that your employees that provide care in the field become vaccinated, and obviously anybody who holds a medical certificate, especially in our state of Washington, and how that's affected the sort of the mental stressors, as if we didn't already have enough, on the worker, the firefighter, the EMT, the police officer, the paramedic, and their families, and even employers. And so let's understand that this is not an employer mandate. This is a federal mandate from Joe Biden office, President Biden. And if you live fortunate enough to live in the state of Washington, by Governor Inslee. So these are governmental mandates, not your boss mandating that you get a vaccine, which is, again, highly recommended that you do so. Two of our organizations, the International Association of Fire Chiefs and the International Association of Firefighters, both endorsed the vaccines. The IAFC, International Association of Fire Chiefs, came out with a stronger statement indicating that employer fire chiefs need to mandate, or ensure that their firefighters are safe and that the vaccine is one way to make them safe. A couple of weeks ago, attorney Brad Pinsky and myself did a radio show talking about, sort of the pros and cons. I was more the pro with a little bit more of, this is a mandate that needs to be carried out in your organization. Brad Pinsky was more of the why in God's name are you going to be firing nurses and doctors and paramedics and EMTs and volunteers and that sort of stuff. So if you want to hear a lively show, you listen to the Lawyers podcast a couple of weeks ago. But in our class yesterday, you asked for the people to raise hands and tell us how many firefighters, EMTs, paramedics are going to be lost as a result of this vaccine mandate. And, pretty much every member that was in the session raised their hand, and their numbers ranged from 2 to 22. These are small to medium-sized Washington departments. When you take the pulse of larger organizations, obviously the numbers are bigger, and then you'll get individuals that decline, like fire chief in Vashon Islands, that I'm not going to get the vaccine. There was a TV show, King 5 News, a week ago or so, where Seattle firefighter said, well, I decided to get it. I was not going to, but taking a look down the road long term, it was important for me and my family and my career that I take the vaccine. not getting into the formulary of what goes into the vaccine. That's for you to read on the scientific journals. And I say, let's listen to the scientists and not the talking heads. Some of the treatments that they have come up with are damn dangerous, and they're not fit for human consumption or human consideration. But there are people out there that will take those sort of alternative pathways for treatments. From a legal aspect, yes, and I say yes twice, because the law that's currently in place that was decided back in 1905 in a court case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts, they had a smallpox pandemic. And so the state compelled mandatory vaccines for all of those residents living in a particular area of Massachusetts. Reverend Jacobson said, there's no way that you cannot force a vaccine upon me. Went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state, indicating that the state police powers and they enabled them to protect the public health. And so the answer is yes, again. Government can mandate vaccines, and these mandates have occurred during the smallpox outbreak, as we just mentioned. Again, today in today's news, there was a, I think, a police case on the East Coast where the police unions have pushed back. The judge just ruled in favor of the employer and of the mandate to become vaccinated. And so I would forecast that the courts are not going to be changing a lot of the law, the seminal law that was decided in 1905 with Jacobson v. Massachusetts. Our state, the Washington state, and several other states, as I mentioned before, have filed a lawsuit against the governor. The governor was first to come out with a mandate, and essentially two of the lawsuits right now have been resolved like a negotiated settlement that said, yes, we understand it creates a hardship on the employee, the employer, and family, and this is how we're going to try to blunt the effects of the mandated vaccines. And so there was, you know, they talked about time off, some incentives to get the vaccine, reasonable accommodations if you're asking for a reasonable accommodation, either a medical exemption or a religious exemption. There really are no philosophical exemptions, like I just don't want to get it, I don't believe in it. Those sorts of things. And so we kind of narrowed this down to medical, if you're allergic to the vaccine and obviously don't get it. The religious exemption is going to create quite the conundrum for the organization because of, you know, sort of the tone and tenor of how do you evaluate somebody's religious beliefs. There has to be a sincerely held belief of a particular religion that basically says that, you know, because of my belief system, I'm asking for an exemption. Two points here. One is that there's no major recognized religion in the world that does not endorse vaccines, whether they're mandated or not is another story. But all the major religions have endorsed obtaining the vaccine when you can. Another sort of side note of this is that there were two recent Washington State Patrol members who essentially obtained a religious exemption through their employer, which is the state of Washington. And the Washington State Patrol came back, according to the latest news, is that they don't have a job because there's no reasonable accommodation for their positions in the Washington State Patrol. The LA City firefighters also have filed a lawsuit against that, the mandated vaccine, and so we're going to be seeing how those are going. I mentioned yesterday Conway Regional Hospital in Arkansas is allowing employees to bypass a vaccine mandate on religious grounds, and they listed a bunch of material that the person applying for the religious exemption because of a stem cell belief that the vaccines are made out of stem cells listed a whole bunch of medications that have been around for 1,000 years. And it was bluntly pointed out yesterday by one of my close friends who's the fire chief in one of the Eastern Washington communities and said, you know, Tylenol, Pepto-Bismol, aspirin, those sorts of things have been around for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years. There is no way stem cells could be incorporated into there. But when you did a little background, some of those have been tested with derivatives of stem cells, but not stem cells themselves. And so for that particular regional healthcare provider, that's going to create quite a distraction as to, you know, like aspirin's been around since, you know, Bobby Halton was walking on water. And it's a product that's been around a long time. I mentioned in my practice as a PA, I prescribe colchicine for gout. And colchicine has been around for over 3,000 years, originated in China way before, you know, stem cells even were envisioned. So I think we need to take these sorts of things we read in the newspaper or online, social media sites, Facebook, and those sorts of things with sort of a grain of salt. And again, there are no philosophical sort of exemptions. So part of this is, you know, how do you review this sort of stuff? So one of the items to consider is that OSHA is coming out with standards, and you got to, like I may say this tonight, Friday night at 4:30 West Coast time, and tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning, there may be an OSHA rule. Our state, we're a OSHA compliant state, so you know our labor and industries group is coming out with standards. The Washington State Fire Chiefs are coming out with standards. The International Association of Fire Chiefs are coming out with standards. Lawyers all over the country are coming out with something, and a lot of them look at, you know, what are the exemptions? How do you process an exemption? And then, you know, if you, as an example, somebody applies for a religious exemption and you reject them, are you subject to a lawsuit because of the religious discrimination that may have occurred on your part because of somebody applying for a religious exemption? The same with a medical exemption. If somebody, you know, says I have a medical exemption, I'm allergic to the vaccine because I have autoimmune disease, that is one of them, and you say no, you have to get the vaccine, did we violate their Americans with Disabilities rights, and are we going to be subject to lawsuit? So I'm telling people, and I said this in yesterday's class, is that if you're going to deny or approve any sort of an exemption, you better document it, because at some point somebody's going to sue somebody as a result of that. So you want to make sure that everything's been documented through the decision process. And my last point today is make sure you have some sort of a policy. It doesn't have to be tight right now because there are no real tight policies, but maybe on Monday, the next 2 days, you're going to have a tighter policy than you have now. But you need to provide some sort of a review process. It needs to be unbiased, and you need to have a policy that outlines how the review standard is going to occur so people know what they're getting into when they get into applying for an exemption. But I'm thinking that at the end of the day, there will be very few people refusing to take the vaccine under these mandates because, again, it's your career as a volunteer. I'm sorry, it's you're a volunteer in an organization. That is like your career. And I bow to Tom Merrill when it's a professional volunteer. When you're a professional firefighter, could be a career ender. And so I think that we need to take a look at the hard science behind, you know, why you're not getting the vaccine. And again, if you have sincerely held beliefs of a religious conviction or a medical excuse, then I would take every liberty on your side in order to take advantage of those. So this is actually Dr. Murphy's show, and I was just doing the preamble of yesterday's class. And Dr. Murphy, you know, we talked yesterday about the inordinate amount of stress that this these vaccine mandates and just COVID has presented not only to society per se, but certainly the fire service as a whole, based on the fact that we've seen a lot of sick people. We've seen a lot of COVID patients. We're dying from COVID. The latest statistic is that probably COVID deaths will exceed actual line of duty deaths from fires and accidents and others, and easily preventable. I wrote an article about a month ago called "Get the Vaccine and Mask Up." Please take time to read it. It may convince you to get the vaccine, but it's created an inordinate amount of stress. And so I think if Dr. Murphy is kind of on the line right now, wave your hand because I'm looking at you. There she is, enjoying the sunshine out here in Washington State. Today, it's the very few days that we have, so she's outside, I'm inside. And so I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Murphy. Dr. Murphy.
Hi. Thank you. I forgot.
My pleasure.
I was like thinking, well, how is he going to know when I, you know, like I was waiting for him to be done and I was on mute doing, you know, my thing. And I'm like, how's he going to know that I'm ready to talk? So he obviously couldn't see me.
I just look out the window and there you are sitting drinking a cold soda.
So obviously, John, my wonderful husband, and dashboard tender and attorney gave you kind of the legal lowdown, which I was listening to, and sometimes it just makes me, I don't know, my brain just says, I'm not going to listen to that. Because it's a lot and it's complicated. And so my brain does what it usually does when it's overwhelmed and tired, it kind of shuts down. And I think that that's what a lot of people are doing in some way, shape, or form. COVID has been going on. Present has altered our lives for about the last 18 months. And it's impacting people. I mean, it's impacting everyone, from the oldest to the youngest of us. And I don't think that people are necessarily aware of how much it is impacting them. When we were talking yesterday to a group, I asked people, "Do you feel off?" And pretty much everybody there is like, well, yeah, I mean, but they'd just been primed by John to talk and think about COVID and the vaccination mandate. So, but it's like, I don't know if I had asked them that without having us having the discussion about COVID, you know, what would they say? So my question to you listening is, have you felt off or out of balance or more tired than usual or lacking motivation or, you know, any of those types of things? This is something that I started having a discussion around this last year. So after COVID first shut things down, you know, so businesses were closing, offices were closing. Basically, people were staying inside, staying in their house, staying by themselves or staying within their bubble. And another, like my best friend and colleague who happens to also be, she's a therapist, we were talking and she asked me, well, how do you feel about all this? And I was like, I don't know. And she actually said it first. She said, you know, I just feel off. And exactly what I was feeling. And I was hesitant to say anything because I really couldn't put my finger on it. I just knew that I didn't feel quite like myself. And I didn't know why. And I wasn't expecting that me feeling off really had anything to do with COVID. But this is something that I've noticed through these 18 months that, you know, I still feel off. And it kind of comes and goes. And same with her as we, you know, continue to have discussions around this. But it's something that I'm hearing more and more and more and more from my clients. And you know, we're seeing it in our communities as well. So there's been an increase in gun violence. There's been an increase in domestic violence. You know, people have a shorter fuse. They are more easily irritated. And, you know, not to say that there's any excuse for somebody to shoot another person or for, you know, one person to beat up another person that they supposedly love. But it seems to be a catalyst. Life is different. So, you know, I want you to just take note. Ask yourself, how do I feel? Do I feel lost? Do I feel like everything is going the same? Do I have control of everything? You know, whatever you want to ask yourself. And then the next question is, do you think that COVID-19, being sick or just the consequences of COVID-19 with the shutdown and the change in our way of life. Like, do you think that that is a stressor or a traumatic stressor? And I asked that question to the group yesterday. And, some people said, yeah, it's just a traumatic stressor. And then some people said, well, it depends or both. So yeah, it's both. I mean, it would be true to say it's both. It is a traumatic stressor the closer you are to the consequences of COVID-19. So, you know, like if you were sick with it and you were really sick with it, if a loved one was really sick with it, someone close to you died from it, being a first responder, if you're responding to it, then yeah, it is a traumatic stressor. It meets the definition that is in the DSM-5, the diagnostic manual that we use to diagnose, then it meets that criterion A trauma. If you're just listening to it on the news and not directly impacted in any way, shape, or form, then it's a stressor. Except that I don't know very many people that haven't been impacted at a greater level in some way. So it's a traumatic stressor. And so the mental health community talks about COVID-19 as a shared traumatic experience. We are all living this particular trauma together. And it definitely is having an impact on people. The reaction, the traumatic stress reaction that we're seeing is in line with the reaction that somebody would have from any traumatic stressor. And it can, if it lingers as it has, look a lot like PTSD. Now, whether or not you're diagnosed with PTSD, of course, depends on how disruptive your symptoms are. So, you know, it's like you could experience some of the symptoms of PTSD, but may, you know, manage it well enough where you're not necessarily where you wouldn't rise to the level of being diagnosed. But for some people, they would experience symptoms to that level that would be required of a diagnosis, and their life is incredibly disrupted. I think for most people, they're experiencing some of the symptoms. I mean, and it could be that like feeling off, that lack of motivation, the sense of helplessness, the lack of control, having your worldview challenged, having your view of others challenged or seeing that change, having a hard time with having hope. I mean, so there are a lot of things that a person can experience that would be part of the PTSD criteria, but they still go on. So, you know, it's like you could meet the criteria, but still function. And so, so I think most people are in that realm where they are experiencing at least some symptoms related to that we would find with PTSD, and with a more extreme case of the, I guess, like the non-overly disruptive symptomology, you know, they may meet all the criteria except for they're still living. They're still, you know, going to work. They're still engaging in whatever they're supposed to be engaging, but maybe the level of it has changed. So anyway, I hope that makes sense. Basically, it's like people are impacted. This is a trauma. It's a traumatic stressor, and we're all living it. So that is really the bottom line. So it's like, what do we do with that? And I think the first thing is that you have to recognize it. I know for myself that I recognize that I have no idea when this is going to stop. I have no idea when things are going to be normal again. And I don't, you know, normal obviously is subjective. So I don't know what your normal is, but I know that what's going on is not my normal. I know that how I do my practice has changed. I know that the things that I recommend to my clients has changed. A lot of times I recommend to my clients that they need to get out and be around people. I work with a lot of firefighters and police officers who have PTSD, or you know, I work with people that have like severe depression. And in both of those cases, the one of the things that occurs often is like withdrawal. So people want to withdraw and isolate from people. So my number one recommendation is often I want you to go out and be around people. You don't have to talk to them. Just be out around people. So at least there's an option to engage with other people. I couldn't do that last year. I couldn't make that recommendation. And I was seeing people really struggling with this isolation. And this year, to some extent, we still have that going on. The other thing is like the working out, you know, like so parks, recreational areas, gyms, those were closed for a large part of last year. So even someone engaging in physical activity was not a possibility unless they had a home gym or they had the motivation to work out at home. And some people did, but a lot of people didn't have the motivation. You know, a lot of people thought, well, I'll take advantage of having to be home and I'll work out more and I'll eat better and I'll, you know, do all these projects around the house that I didn't do. And I don't think a lot of people actually followed through with that. I mean, I know some people did, and I am like, I applaud those people. But there are a lot of people that didn't because they were impacted by that lack of motivation, that sense of feeling off. And then on top of that, they just set themselves up even worse. So, you know, it's like they wanted to do all these things, but then they didn't. So then that just contributed to, like, that sense of failure. And I know that now, with things opened up, like, some people are getting back into the gym. They're getting out into nature. They're tackling some of those projects. But now we have, like, kind of a – we have a – another factor that is in all this, and it's what John was talking about. It's the mandate for vaccination and the divide that it has created. So people are divided and disconnected, and that sense of fear and helplessness feeling all along has been magnified. And so people are, you know, they're fighting back, and, you know, it's like you might feel helpless, but you don't want somebody to tell you what to do. You might not know what to do, but you still don't want somebody to tell you what to do unless you asked, and unless you went and said, I don't know what to do with this. We talked a lot about, like, there's, like, a lot that we don't know, but there's also a lot that we do know. And so one of the things that I recommended was to, you know, focus on what we do know. I mean, yes, there is some changing information coming out, and there's new information coming out, which is true of anything. You know, if you have ever struggled with cancer, or you have a family member, you know somebody that has struggled with cancer, basically the recommended treatments of the day were research 5 years prior. And then by the time they get applied, then there's been more research that has maybe altered, you know, what that protocol would be. It doesn't make that protocol wrong, but it's like with new information, they're able to fine tune whatever that treatment was. So our research always lags behind. And I've noticed that with, you know, like neuroscience and neurobiology. So that's something that I've really gotten into more now as I work with firefighters and police officers. Most of them are men, and I have to find a way to them and help and try and overcome, you know, that stigma around mental health. And I found that being able to talk with them from a perspective of science, of like, this is why you might have developed PTSD. That helps overcome the stigma. So, you know, and I get the question a lot is why can't I handle this? Why did I develop PTSD? And so going into kind of the basics of neuroscience and neurobiology and how the body works, how the body responds automatically to the exposures to trauma and traumatic stress, that helped me be able to explain it in a way that it's like, it's not a flaw in you. This is how human beings work. And I have learned a lot more recently, in part because of my interest, but in part because of the research. So when I was in grad school, like over, I don't know, like over 13 years ago or something like that, I was taking classes that I wasn't, or maybe it was like over 15 years ago, but it's like the neurobiology, neuroscience classes, the classes of the senses and so forth. It's like, it just wasn't that interesting to me. And what was being taught didn't seem relevant to me, as far as what I was going to need to do therapy with someone. And And so I've learned different. I've learned that going to that biological basis for some things kind of helps take out that argument of I'm weak. But also science and the research that's been done more of late has really expanded that knowledge base. So research is always changing what we know. So there will always be some new information coming out, and that is something that we could count on. So it's like what we know about COVID right now, it will change as the research comes out, and so we will learn some new things. But there are things that are kind of stable throughout the whole thing. And it repeatedly comes back to that, at the very beginning, it was wash your hands, don't touch your face, wear a mask. I mean, that was pretty much what we had available to us. That's what they said to do. That's what we did. And it helped in a lot of ways, but it didn't help in every way. But it helped. And so that is one thing that can continue. And we've also seen, like, from the numbers that it definitely helped with the number of colds and flu that people got. I mean, as far as we could see, you know, and maybe people weren't going to the doctor when they got the flu. So, you know, it's hard to say, like, why the numbers totally were down, but it would be kind of safe. It would be safe to say that that hygiene practices had a lot to do with that. So there are some basics that we know. There are basics that have not changed throughout the years. And so that's where we focus, is what do we know? Because there is a lot we don't know, and there is a lot that will be changing, but what do we know? So that can help with that sense of helplessness. Limiting the amount of news on it, it can be helpful. Technology and social media and this, like, instant connectedness to everything is great, but it also has changed how we get information and who can provide the information. And so it really is important find places that we can trust with the information. And I know a lot of people talk about, they don't trust the government. And it's like, that's fine. You don't have to trust the government. And it's just that everybody has an agenda. And so, you know, it's like listen to everything and take it with a grain of salt. I heard one of my clients go off on science and how numbers can be explained any way you want them to, and it's like, I mean, I'm not going to debate this with her, but yeah, sure, you can interpret things, but there's still a basis of, I want to say a basis of truth in what is there. You know, they generally, you know, you have your demographics where you're reporting numbers and only the numbers, like the number of people in the hospital, for instance. That's a number. And that number is representative of the number of people that they actually were able to count. But you can't do anything with that number, you know, like comparing it to other populations or something like that. So you have to do a statistical manipulation. And so it gets really confusing. It's like, I had statistics and I get confused by it sometimes. I'm like going, well, what did they do with this? What are they comparing it to? So you could look at discrete numbers if you want to, but I depend on scientists and peer-reviewed articles to get information that is that helps to explain these things, because it's like I'm not a statistician, and I understand it, but to a level, a certain level, but I'm not expert in that area. And I have too many other things I want to learn to want to spend time to learn about that. So it's like you have to decide how you want to spend your time. And I don't want to redo the statistics on the numbers that, you know, researchers have already done. I will read it and I will read it critically. And I understand that there's some subjectivity in how things get interpreted, but I don't base my opinion on one thing. So it's important to find multiple sources to find convergent data. And then I also pay attention to divergent data. You know, like if there's something out there that says absolutely this is not true, then I read that and I look at like why is this one so different? So, you know, when you're trying to make a decision for yourself and you're trying to have a sense of control and to not feel helpless, then it's helpful to be able to do some of your own searching and finding information and answering some of these unknowns. But you're not a scientist, and so you're not going to know everything. And so it's finding enough so that you can make an informed decision. And it's okay if you don't want to trust the government, but if they, you know, provide information that is in line with your own research that you've done, your own sources that you've found, then, you know, you can choose to follow the recommendation. You don't have to trust the person that is making the recommendation if the recommendation is sound. And I'm not sure if that makes sense. Hopefully that did. But it basically, it's like do what you need to do so that you feel like you have some sense of control. You know, there's people do a lot of things out of fear and when they feel like they don't have control. And one of those things is they take a stance, even if it might be to their detriment, they will take a stance. And that, unfortunately, is something that we've seen in some cases. So I know John brought up the firefighter that said that they were absolutely not going to get the shot, and then he got COVID and he got really sick, and you know, and then there's stories, you know, so anecdotal evidence that people have refused to get the shot and then it changed their mind, but it was too late. But again, it's like those are anecdotal stories. So that's not hard science. So it's like find a way to feel like you have some control, and don't get bogged down in the not knowing, and go to what you do know. This is something that, you know, when you're working with kids, for instance, when kids are learning, and it's, you know, when you're learning something new, you know, a kid, they'll get really frustrated and then they'll quit and they're not want to do it. And so one way to help them feel successful is to go back to the last thing that they were successful with, you know, so basically that last thing that they knew and they understood and it made sense. And honestly, it's like adults are not that much different, particularly when they're in a state of this unknowing and fear and feeling off. So it's like, go with what you know. So I've said that in so many different ways. I think I just will stop with that one. So let's talk about some other things. Like what can you do with this? So we're having this shared traumatic experience. And we know that there are things we don't know and there are things we do know. So it's like we're going to find a way to have a sense of control. So that's one thing. Fortunately, things have shifted a bit. So, you know, we can have more of a normal, and I'm using air quotes, quote unquote, normal life. So, you know, working out, getting into nature, walking, going to a restaurant, spending time with friends and family. I mean, we can do these things. And those are things that we need to do. Those are important. It's important to deal with this constant, like, activation. So COVID as a traumatic stressor, it's not like you got exposed to the stressor and you had your stress response and then it went away. It's like this constant underlying stressor. And so what happens with that stress response? With this stress response, you know, you're seeing this activation. So normally, and you will all like know what this feels like. So when you get stressed by something, you have a reaction of, you know, like maybe your heart rate increases, respiration increases, muscle tension increases, might have, you know, GI changes, and then there may be changes you notice like cognitively, you know, alertness. You might be, you know, notice that you're like more aware of noises. You know, so it's just those things, like if we experience a discrete stressor, our body is designed to get us ready to respond to it. And we're either going to fight or flee, generally. And so that happens with every stress response that we experience. It's part of our survival mechanism. The other part of it also is like making negative appraisals. And so negative appraisals might, it would look like, you know, like if there's you're walking and there's a stick in the pathway. The first appraisal that is generally made is like, that's a snake. And then as you, like, if you choose to approach and get closer, you're like, oh, it's just a stick. And then you kind of laugh at yourself. But your body had already reacted to the potential that was a snake. And it will do that every single time. I use the example of like a brown rock off into the distance or a brown mound in the distance. You know, would have seen that and they would have thought that's a lion. And then they would have steered clear. And then they may have discovered, oh, that was just a rock. Well, defaulting to that negative appraisal of like, that's dangerous, that helps ensure that we survive. And so that translates into like today where we have more negative thoughts. A study that was done was it showed that 80% of our thoughts are negative. And we honestly, we don't pay attention to all of them. Like, we don't even know that we have that many thoughts. So it's like we're not always thinking about what we're thinking. But there is that tendency towards negative thinking. So that's part of our survival mechanism as well. So when you're exposed to traumatic stressors, then all of these things kick in. And when you have a traumatic stressor, then your body and brain, it does what it's supposed to do, and then you eventually come, you know, back to like a homeostasis, a level period where you've kind of recovered, and then you're kind of reset. So you reset and recover, and you're ready for the next experience. As a first responder, it's like you're exposed to like the everyday stressors, and then the stressors associated with your job, and the stressors of the people that you are responding to, stressors of the people that you work with. And so it's like you might be reacting to your own stressors, traumatic or otherwise, and you might be coming down and moving towards that recovery, but then you're exposed to another stressor. So then you elevate back up. Your body, again, gets ready for that fight flight. So another term to use is the alarm system or alert. So it's, you know, alarm and calm or alert and calm. And I'm using those terms because it makes sense in the sense that there are a lot of things that are stressors that we would not necessarily label as a stressor that would induce a fight flight response. So it helps, I think, to think of it more in terms of like alert. So you get stimulated into a state of alertness so that you can respond in some way. So we're constantly being exposed to something. In the fire service, there's always something. And even if you're trained to respond, it still causes your body to react. But your mind says, you can handle this. And that's one of the reasons why we train like we fight and fight like we train. So that when we're going into stressful situations, we don't have to think. We can do, and because we're doing something that we're trained to do, then that helps to, you know, calm us so that we can then engage in thinking and decision making when we need to. So when we're overstressed, we're not thinking well. So we have all these kind of normal and not so normal stressors. I mean, in the fire service, it's like, yes, that's all normal. It's part of the job. The reaction that we're having is normal, and it's part of our survival mechanism. And then you have COVID-19. And for 18 months, we've been exposed to this constant threat to life, to our way of life, to our connection with people, to how we feel about the world, even. And it's been there as a constant. And this is why we feel off. And so then we have this and all the other stressors. And so it's like our baseline is heightened. And we are operating from a heightened, stressed baseline. So even small things can create a big stress response. So that's that like lower tolerance for things. And that contributes to some of the, you know, more extreme behaviors that we've seen, like with that rise in domestic violence. So what do we do about it? And that's the big thing, is like, how do we deal with a stressor that is this kind of, I mean, it's a significant stressor, but because it's present in some way, shape, or form every day, I think it kind of gets put in the background, or it's something that underlies every other stressor. And so it's not always on our mind. It's not always something that we are thinking we have to adjust for, which is okay, but it's like it's present. So the impact of that is pleasant. And sometimes we need to slow down and feel what we're feeling and go, okay, I recognize what's going on. So like the conversation my girlfriend and colleague and I have on occasion of, you know, I just feel off. And so if you acknowledge nothing else, just acknowledging that is actually a really big step. So what can you do about it? So for you as an individual, it's important to move. I mean, if you're not motivated to exercise, then move your body, get outside and move. Recognize that being on Zoom calls or doing virtual happy hours or whatever it is, it's like those are stressful. It causes you, like you're close up and it causes you to have to focus. And when you're focused, you increase the muscle tension in your eyes. And that trickles down to increase, like it causes an activation in the body. So it's something that most people don't notice unless you're like really super in tune with your body. And then you might notice that, well, when I get off a Zoom call, I'm like just exhausted. But that close up focus can create some stress. So that's why it's important to get outside. You can get outside and you can look up and you can look out in the distance. And that has a significant calming effect because you're looking up and out and it allows the eyes to relax. And when the eyes relax, that has a cascading effect on the rest of the body. So looking up and out to the distance is really helpful. Movement and then breathing. I mean, I'm sure you all have recognized that when you get stressed out, you don't breathe so well. You might notice that you catch yourself and you take a deep breath in. And I know personally I have when I get stressed and I'll take a deep breath and I'm like, wow, I must be stressed. I wasn't breathing. Or you yawn or sigh. I mean, those are indicators that you're stressed and not breathing well. But our breath is really important as far as helping us be relaxed. And so breathing from the diaphragm is really important to maintain some level of relaxation. I shared yesterday, there is a neurobiologist who has a podcast. His name is Andrew Huberman, and I believe I've mentioned him before. I really, really like his podcast because he talks about the science, and then he provides protocols. So basically, like, here's this really cool science, and then this is how you use it in your life. And so, you know, he talked about like the vision aspect, that being close up and focused versus the looking out into the distance. And so he talked about how that is important not only for eye health, but also for well-being, to, you know, like feel better, to feel more relaxed. He specifically has a podcast that is focused on stress, which is, he talks about the stress response in the body. So the alarm system and the calming system and, you know, what happens in each. And then he actually talks about, here's some things that you can do. So it's like, even though these systems are automatic in our bodies, we can actually use them so we can engage them on purpose. So they will respond automatically when we're under stress, but we can use them to our advantage. So when you notice that you are stressed out, then you can do a physiological breath, or sigh, I'm sorry, physiological sigh is what he calls it. And he talks about how to do that. And basically it is breathing in, taking a full breath in, and then another little small breath, and then blowing it out and engaging the diaphragm. And that stimulates the calming system. So that exhale and the engagement of the diaphragm will stimulate our calming system. And it does a couple other things, which he talks about, which I highly recommend that you listen to that podcast. If you're feeling tired, unmotivated, sluggish, whatever, then doing a breathing style that is like a deep breath in and then kind of let your breath fall out. So you're not engaging the diaphragm. You're not breathing out long. It's kind of a short breath out, like it's just a release, almost like a hyperventilation. That type of breathing stimulates the alarm or alert system. So that will make you feel more alert and energized. And so you can use that also. So those breathing exercises are part of his podcast on stress management. And if you look for his stuff, he has a YouTube channel that is a recording of his podcast. And then he has a podcast that's available through iTunes or Spotify or, you know, pretty much anywhere you get your podcast. And in those, he has them transcribed and they are timestamped. So you could look up physiological sigh and you could actually go to that spot. So I recommend checking it out. All his stuff is really great. And so there might be other things there that you might like. So he addresses a lot of different areas. So it basically with COVID and every other stressor that you're experiencing, it's to take care of yourself and to essentially return to the simple things. And that's something that has been coming up a lot, I've noticed, with my clients, that they're finding the most joy in simple. And I am reminded of that myself as we're hanging out with my four-year-old grandson and he wants to play. And I can't think of anything more simple than a four-year-old playing or playing with a four-year-old. And so it's, you know, it's taking care of yourself. Don't make it complicated. It's simple. That's one of the things that really comes out of like listening to Huberman's podcast, is that a lot of the things that we can do to help ourselves are things that our body would naturally do in some capacity. So that physiological sigh, for instance, is something that you might notice if you've ever found yourself crying and you're trying to recover from that, then the way that you breathe when you're in that trying to recover from and stop yourself from crying, that is essentially what the physiological sigh is. It's kind of more like a sob. So like when you go from crying to sobbing to, okay, now I'm okay. So to me, it's like that breath sounds like a sob. So it's like, it's simple. I mean, our does what it needs us to do, and we need to pay attention so that we can do it for ourselves if we need to. So movement, getting outside, breathing, and meditation. Meditation is important because it can help us tolerate what we don't want to tolerate. And usually when I mention meditation, people roll their eyes. But, you know, we're not talking about like that meditation where you clear your mind. It's the meditation, like a mindful meditation, something you can do. You can do it while you're moving. You can do it while you're doing kind of mindless chores, like washing the dishes, vacuuming a rug. You know, the only thing that is really necessary in that sense is that you're focusing on that moment and what you're doing and not getting caught up in what you might be thinking or feeling. And not thinking about what you're going to do next, for instance, like, you know, going through your to-do list or what you're going to do tomorrow or worrying about what you did in the past or what you're going to do tomorrow. It's recognizing that when thoughts like that might come up, you label it as, well, that's a thought. And then you go back to whatever you were doing. So if you're sitting and breathing, then you would go back to breathing. If you're washing dishes, then you would go back to washing dishes. Whatever it is, being engaged in it, being aware of all your senses in relation to what you're doing. If you're outside walking, it's noticing how your foot strikes the pavement, noticing your posture, what your body feels like in relation to where you're at, you know, kind of having an awareness of where you're at. What do you hear? What do you see? What do you smell? What do you feel on your skin? So basically it's just focusing in on what you're doing in that moment and then engaging all five senses in whatever it is that you're doing, if that's possible. And then when, you know, when, if a thought comes up, regardless what it is, you label it as, well, that's a thought or that's an emotion. And not getting into, oh, that's a bad thought, I can't think that way or whatever. So it's probably one of the hardest, simplest things you can do sometimes, but over time it gets a lot easier. So it's not necessary to empty your mind. You can have lots of thoughts. And part of it is noticing that you have lots of thoughts and that you don't have to believe them. You don't have to follow them. And then noticing how you feel and that you can tolerate feeling uncomfortable. And doing that allows you to sit with something that you don't particularly want to experience. And the more you do it, the less uncomfortable it is and the less time that lingers. The other thing that's really important is getting sleep. And that could be a whole nother show. So there's a whole thing around sleep hygiene. But, you know, it's like create a routine. Try to go to bed, you know, as close to the same time as possible and get up as close to the same time as possible. And shoot for between 7 and 9 hours of sleep. And, you know, because we sleep in 90-minute cycles, trying to end sleep at the end of a 90-minute cycle. So, like, 7.5 hours, for instance, would be at the end of a 90-minute cycle. But there could be more that goes into that. So, again, it's like going back to Huberman. He does a great podcast with Matthew Walker around sleep. And I know that a lot of people in the fire service are familiar with Matthew Walker. He wrote a book, I believe it's called Why We Sleep. So he's a sleep expert. And so again, you know, they talk about the science, they talk about what they know, and then they provide protocols. So you know, things that you can do to get to sleep. And so what I had just suggested as part of that, there is a great app that can be useful. It's CBTI, so it's Cognitive Behavioral Therapy -I for insomnia. It's put out by the VA, and it's a well-done app. It's free, and it is it's easy to use if you want to track your sleep. And then it also provides a lot of information and tools that you can use if you have trouble sleeping, which I know a lot of people in the fire service do have some problems with sleeping. So that can be a really useful tool. The VA also put out an app called COVID Coach, which is a newer app, obviously. And I just looked at it the other day, and I really liked it. So it's pretty good quality, and it has a lot of suggestions. And then it has a capability to kind of track mood and your activity and such. So you can kind of look at how your moods might track, how your sleep tracks, how you're coping with things, what coping you're employing effectively. And that can help you look at, well, what do you need to change? What do you need to add? So that's a great one. If you're, you know, interested in the meditation and breathing, there are so many apps out there that you could use. I really like Breathe, which is BREETHE, because it offers a variety of modalities. And I've found it to be very useful. Calm is another common one. And Calm has a Calm series that is on HBO Max. It's not everything that Calm offers, but it's a, kind of like a limited type series, and you could watch it over and over again. Headspace has a great app, and they also offer their meditation stuff on Netflix. So if you don't want to pay for the membership for Headspace, for instance, you do have Netflix, then you could watch it on Netflix on, you know, pretty much any tablet or phone or TV, if your TV has an app type capability. So that's a great resource. Other resources that are really good, like if you're, you want to know more, the websites that I trust that I like to go to, especially, for anything psychologically related and trauma related, APA.org, so the American Psychological Association. They have a COVID page, so if you want to learn more about what to do and how to address COVID, you could go there, and it has a variety of links. ISTSS.org, it's the International Study for Traumatic Stress, International Studies of Traumatic Stress Society, ISTSS.org. That's a trauma-based international organization, and that's a really good one. They also have a COVID page. And so that actually links you to information that is around the world. So you can see, what is going on and how things are being addressed outside of the United States. And then regardless of If you go to the state psychological association, like I'm in Washington State, so mine would be WAPSYCH, so wasych.org. That's for the Washington State Psychological Association. They have a COVID page as well. And your state, if you're in a different state, you could probably just, you know, Google your state psychological association, and they would have, they likely will have a COVID page as well. and then for medical information, so like COVID specific information, like more of the number statistics information about, you know, the virus, the vaccines and so forth. The biggest sites that I go to and read, like more like so statewide or statewide, like United statewide, is this is CDC, which I know some people are like, well, that's a governmental agency, I don't trust it, but it is the, you know, one of the biggest repositories of scientific information on COVID and every other disease. So I will go there. I also will go to the WHO website, so the World Health Organization, to see what they have to say. And sometimes their information is a little bit different than the CDC, but it is not vastly different. And I've heard people say that it's, you know, like WHO is saying something different than what CDC says. And it's like, it's not different per se. I mean, the organizations have slightly different purposes. And so the differences that you see is more about the difference in the purpose. And so, you know, it's like one is more about making recommendations based on the information, and one is more about just providing the information. So those are good sites. The Public Health Department, I find, is a useful site. And again, I know that it's something that people don't always trust because there's government attached to it. But, you know, again, it's like if you're going to sites and they're saying the same thing or something really similar, then you're getting information that is trustworthy. You know, so it's like scientific studies can disprove something, but they can't prove something. They can only sorry, I have a cough. I feel like I inhaled a bug. And then some of these sites, like if you go on them, they may actually link you to some different sites as well. So you could like really easily go down the rabbit hole by following all the links. But, you know, if you're trying to find the information you need so you can make an informed decision to take care of yourself, then, you know, it's like then start looking at these sites and look at how, and I, you know, I go to these sites because they're ones that throughout my education and my practice are ones that have come up over and over and over again. You know, you can also look at the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association, you know, so they're all going to have pages related to COVID. And then you can also look at like your state worker comp websites too for information. So, and then I did this yesterday too. I talked about it just from the perspective of like you as the adult, the, you know, the firefighter. This affects your family as well. And so the recommendations that I made and the things that I suggested for you to help you feel better and feel calmer, it's like those things, they work for anybody. And they'll even work for children. So if you have kids and you're seeing like behavioral issues with your kids, that's a sure sign that they're being impacted by whatever stressors are going on. They're not immune just because they're kids. They follow your lead, basically. So it's like as much as you might try and protect your kids, your loved ones, because there's a connection between you, they still get a sense of what's going on. And so they may not know or understand what it is, but they will feel it. And kids, particularly if they're school-age kids and they've just had to go through a year of virtual learning. And again, that's a whole nother topic as far as like child development. But you can help your kids out by encouraging the same things that I suggested for you. You know, so kids can learn to meditate. There are like awesome resources for that. So with my grandkids who are almost 7, 4.5 and 2.5, there's an app called Moshi. It's M-O-S-H-I, which I introduced them to, and it has a variety of modalities as well, but we use it a lot at night for the sleep stories. So they love hearing these stories at night, and they're just really cute made up stories with someone talking really soft voice, and then there's like soft music and you know, maybe a white noise or something in the background, but something that can really help them fall asleep. And then they also have some daytime stuff for like meditating and breathing and, you know, dealing with difficult feelings. Headspace has a kid section. Breathe has a kid section. I mean, pretty much any of the apps that I mentioned will have a kid section. And then there are books out there that are focused on, you know, kids and dealing with like difficult emotions and relaxing and, you know, teaching some really simple techniques, you know, like grounding techniques or breathing or, you know, counting to 10 or something like that. So, it's a way that you can help your kids. And then talking to them, being open and talking and, you know, be transparent with them about what's going on. Of course, you know, being mindful of their age. So, you know, using a language that they can understand because they know that something's going on. They know that something's off, just like everybody else. And so helping them put words to it will help them as well. And it might help you in having to find a way to explain it all. So is enough for me today. I did add a little bit more than what I added yesterday. So I hope that you find all this useful and that you're able to find the answers that you need so that you can make an informed decision. And that maybe all of this will help bring everybody closer together instead of being so divided. In crisis, we always do better when we can share the load with other people. And I know a lot of people out there are feeling very alone and on their own, and like they don't think that, you know, their coworker or their employer doesn't have their back. And so I think everybody's trying to do the best that they can and the right thing for themselves. And it gets complicated when things get so polarized. So keep an open mind, learn what you can, get the information from multiple sources, and make the best decision that you can for yourself, and take care of each other. And that's all I've got for tonight. So thank you for listening. I hope you made it through this really long discussion and that you get something out of it. So thank you all, and have a very good night.